Christopher DeLorenti.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for coming up here. You just performed Ravel's Bolero for us.
I did.
And you wanted to outline how that happened for people that weren't able to witness it?
Absolutely. The recording is Serge Koussevitzky leading the Boston Symphony Orchestra in a recording of Ravel's Bolero, Ravel's big hit, which he lamented after it became so huge. I reinterpreted or played or improvised with Bolero on the flapophone. The flapophone is a turntable made of cardboard that is hand cranked, and it uses a nail for a needle, actually a wire brad, which can be a bit hard to find, strangely enough, and a typical binder clip to hold the needle. I use the butt end of a pen to turn the 78. I drill a special hole that's maybe about an inch off the center hole to put the crank in. And I listen. I spin the record, I listen to it, and I try and play it. And I try and play it in a way that honors the original music and hopefully for those who know the piece, they can get past or get through hearing it and they hear all of the other things that are happening, the lo-fi artifacts, the faults, the mistakes, and maybe experience and feel those as part, as an addition to the music, or at least as part of the process. With the flapophone, the variations in pitch make the labor, the work of cranking and turning the record obvious, and I hope that that includes or maybe enfolds a bit of my personality in that as well. Sometimes maybe speeding up to get to somewhere that is more exciting, or I'll find that the needle is kind of in a trough and it's squealing and I want it to squeal more, so mm-hmm. I wobble a little bit, or maybe I slow down, or the needle is accumulating because essentially it's plowing in a brute sense, it's plowing through the vinyl grooves and acquiring detritus that's preventing its ability to vibrate and to communicate what's in the groove, so it becomes dull, and then all of a sudden the shavings pop out and all of a sudden it springs to life. So it's a very hands-on way to process these old recordings. The flapophone is mounted. I strap it. I tape it. I use a Scotch brand 3M 1090 tape. Not that that's an endorsement. I just buy the stuff by the case because I use it in my field recording work. But I strap the flapophone to the top of my laptop, which some think is kind of, it's sort of an ironic place, but the laptop, the top screen part, having a gap between the screen and the keyboard and the screen itself being somewhat hollow, adds a little bit of extra resonance to what's going on.
Mm. And listeners who think that maybe they're picturing something more rudimentary than it actually was are probably wrong. It's a fairly rough design.
It's a very rough design, and it's inspired by the Card Talk record player, which was invented by Joy Ritterhoff and her team of fellow Christian missionaries about 60 years ago. They wanted to find a way to bring the good word, whether you believe it's the good word or not, to people who could not read or write. So they pressed 78 records and they figured, well, we need a way to play these. We can't afford to buy gramophones. So they stumbled upon the design. I heard about the design and couldn't find an example of a Card Talk player. There are folks who have found them and since blogged about them. So for me, making the flapophone is kind of a primitive reverse engineering of something I'd only seen in a grainy photo, in a grainy movie. Then there was a documentary that came out as I was working on this called The Tailenders, which had a nice close-up of the Card Talk. So I was able to study that a little bit more, and gradually just experimenting with different kinds of cardboard, cutting out shapes in the cardboard, working with different nails, and finally settling upon the wire brad, that actually a bunch of wire brads I've had since I was a kid, and affixing the wire brad to the flapophone with a standard binder clip, and then figuring out how to mount the record on a sort of on a platter, and actually sits on just a piece of square cardboard, and there's a bushing, nylon bushing that's punched through, that sits through, and that's really what it is. It's very primitive. It's kind of anti-laptop music, although I should say I do use laptops in live performance, so I don't oppose laptops, but I try and make sure that there are at least oppositions in my own work of what I do as a composer, as an improviser, making quote-unquote music, sound art. These oppositions are very important to me. When they clash, they make me think of new things. They make me do things that I wouldn't ordinarily do, and they impel me to failure. Artists are always impelled to failure because that's part of what we do. But unusual failures, different failures, can force us to think of things differently. Instead of striking out at the plate with a baseball bat, you show up at the baseball game and you have a cricket bat, and that disrupts the entire scene. And that's the kind of failure I'm interested in.
Mm-hmm. And we took a little video, so hopefully that'll be up. And if we get it up by the time this broadcast, I'll put a link on the playlist so people can actually see it. But while I was watching you perform, I was thinking, and you've sort of already answered this question, I was thinking how much of this is performative, how much of this is just the struggle with the instrument, and maybe how faithful are you trying to be with reproducing the record that you're using. But it sounds like it's almost like a duo, that in a certain sense it's making choices, it's presenting things, and you're responding like two improvisers would.
Absolutely. I do feel that it's a dialogue with the past. I perform and play works, records that are available, have since been reissued on CD, that actually are not that difficult to find as recordings themselves. The 78s can be hard to find, but I'm working with an earlier draft, if you will, of that recording, in a more vulnerable draft, and I'm trying to see what comes of it when I interact and I perform those records.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll play part of the record a little bit backwards. There are variations in speed. There are mistakes when the needle collapses or the flap falls forward. Those accidents insert breaks. If you go back to the idea of Stockhausen's moment form, where he had where he created these inserts, so my inserts, to make an unruly and an unfair and an inappropriate comparison, my inserts are far more fault filled. But in doing these as duets, I'm also interested in bridging a gap between acoustic music, especially classical acoustic music, and electronic or electroacoustic music. There's a funny thing that's going on, and it's still going on. There is, of course, the giant divide that still happens between so-called composed and so-called improvised music. And when people wonder about that, I say, well, let's sit down and let's listen to that great Blue Note record that Cecil Taylor and his unit created, Conquistador.
Mm-hmm.
And there are two takes of With Exit. And you listen to those two takes, and you understand that the gap, so-called gap, between improvisation and composition is maybe not as wide as as folks might think. So for me, I'm interested, with the flapophone, to establish a continuum between electroacoustic and acoustic music. Too many critics, too many music writers, especially in the mainstream, are those who are interested in, say, someone like Helmut Lachenmann or Olga Neuwirth or Matthias Pinscher, folks like that, or some of the cats who came a little bit before them, Brian Ferneyhough or James Dillon, the New Complexity folks, won't articulate or even express or understand a relationship between those composers and the composers who were making and predominantly work in electroacoustic or pre-recorded sound. And that's very strange to me, because most of the music that we do listen to is in one form or another electroacoustic.
Mm-hmm.
Live music, the the balance is flipped between listening to live music and recordings being incidental to recordings being central, and live music maybe a bit of frosting on the cake. I have to say, and it's a dangerous admission to make, that I have been moved, profoundly moved, moved to tears, moved to a place where my soul has been shaken far more often by recordings than I have by live performances. And I go to a lot of live performances, and I've been dazzled and devastated and amazed and gratified and inspired by live performances as well. But if I was forced to choose between one or the other, well, I don't know how I would actually make that choice. But I just have to say that the proportion is weighted towards wonderful recordings. And I'm not like Roger Sessions, you know, in his book Questions About Music, who can't imagine anyone wanting to listen to a recording at the same recording over and over and hear the same tempi, which would get inflexible, to hear the same phrasing. Well, that, I think, reflects a limited form of listening. As much as I like Roger Sessions and I think his late symphonies are awesome crags of orchestral might, nonetheless, recordings change because we have changed in the interim. Sure. So that's another one of my beliefs. So I just want to establish that continuum and explore it. It doesn't need to be established. I misspoke. I just want to explore it.
I can't say I'm there with you. Not to start a debate, but for me, live performance is just like, recordings just never touch it for me. And I love, you know, I've got lots of souvenirs.
Yes.
But yes, that's sort of what they are to me.
Yeah.
One other interesting thing with the flapophone is that, and I've noticed with certain performers like turntablists like Maria Chavez and Motoko Shimizu, they have obviously made the choice. They can have what they want on the table. They've made the choice to have only one turntable, which is counter to what most turntablists do. It means you have to stop at some point, unless you just use one side the whole time. I feel like that's something you use to your advantage somehow. You're obviously aware of it anyway.
Well, I'm definitely inspired. You know, there's that wonderful book, Pink Noises, where Maria, who I've only met once, utterly briefly and fleetingly, at one of her performances, which just amazed me and knocked me out. And to see that she had built in limitations, she didn't tell me, but she was telling someone else that, well, I just have what I can fit in my backpack. And that is tremendously, it's obvious, but it's liberating, because the model of the DJ, of course, is to tote crate after crate after crate and to get ready to say, well, boy, someone's going to request some sort of a crypto Euro disco. So naturally the DJ will think, crypto Euro disco, what do I want to play? Oh yes, of course, Soft Space, you know, from the Soft Machines, Alive and Well in Paris, a very sad farewell, sad in the good sense and sad in the bad sense to a wonderful group. Well, if you don't have the crate with that Soft Machine record, then you have to acknowledge and work with that limitation. So for myself, I see, and this is where I borrow from, or thieve, or maybe slide or elide myself in a sleazy way into the classical music tradition, but I do see myself as a conductor, and that the program is what I have with me. That's the program. I figured today it's Bolero, and Bolero will, you know, that's what's on the program, not the Pines of Rome, not La Mer, not not some John Cage 78s, which I don't think I could bring myself to play. They haven't been released. I think they're really rare, so I think they need to be preserved before they're played on the flapophone. I've only played things that are, you know, commercially available and still around, and that's also to give listeners the chance to say, oh, okay, so that was the Capriccio for piano and orchestra, you know, Stravinsky and Ernst Anserme or whoever, and so they go find that recording and they compare, and maybe the flapophone performances might even shed some interesting light on the originals, or at least they'll send someone back to the originals. They'll think, oh God, you know, that Bolero had no tempo. I want to go find what what Koussevitzky did, right? So there's that aspect as well.
Right. Yeah, well, it's such an iconic thing to use, Bolero, as you say.
Yeah.
Right? Whether you're thinking of Bo Derek or, you know, any other time you've heard that, but it's just, it's so in the culture that...
Yeah, it's one of the five pieces of classical music that, you know, folks who don't know classical music, they'll hear it and they'll go, oh, yeah.
Right. It's in your grandma's Reader's Digest box of 10 LPs. And
that's right. You know, great music by great composers. And there it is. Although Ravel, his Rhapsody Espagnole for orchestra, which Stravinsky described as the dernier cri in harmonic writing in 1908, it's still dazzling. It's still amazing. So there's lots of... amazing Ravel, and it's understandable why he lamented the popularity of that piece. So that too, others knowing it so well or feeling it so well, there's a lot more to play with when playing that piece and interpreting it on the flapophone.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Ravel, we have the CD here. Does Ravel make it on here? Am I remembering wrong?
No,
he doesn't.
The favorite intermission CD.
I think it made heavy rotation here at WFMU.
Oh, lovely.
Your favorite intermissions is recordings made during intermission of symphonic concerts.
That's right, symphony orchestra concerts all across the country. There was an intermission I recorded where Ravel's Bolero was on the program, and the orchestra did what quite a few orchestras will do with boleros. They bring the poor percussionist who's playing the snare and has to be completely on, right? Cannot mm-hmm. miss. It's like the whoever's playing maracas for Reich's four organs. I mean, holy moly,
right.
That's a job. So the snare, the percussionist was brought out, and she was there and playing at intermission and testing, tightening the snare, and the other musicians were playing and warming up, and I thought, oh goodness, I've always wanted an intermission based on Bolero. I loved it. It was so wonderful, and I listened, and I was so excited. I didn't even stick around for the second half of the concert. I figured, oh, I got to go home and, you know, put on the headphones and see what I got. And I stepped outside the venue, pulled out my MD, which was secreted in my shirt pocket, and I don't remember if I screamed out a curse. I know inside me, my soul was rent because the deck had been left in pause the whole time.
No.
And as an MZ, it was a Sony MZR50, so that SOB deck could stay in pause for an incredible amount of time. Greatest mini disc, portable mini disc recorder ever built. Stayed in pause the whole time. I missed it, but I do remember it. I'm telling you about it. Those of us who are hearing our voices will hear about it. So sometimes you do, you know, you do lose these recordings and you fail, and they are, you know, they are forever gone. And there's nothing you can do. Part of it in capturing those intermissions is that I was flying blind. I couldn't look down and say, oh, yeah, I got to press my record button. I would feel through my shirt pocket and move a portion of my shirt, maybe 1 centimeter or 0.5 centimeter one direction or another, and just hope that the deck would be engaged to record. So with that uncertainty, I lost... or didn't get quite a few intermissions that I thought were really great and wonderful. But that's just how it goes.
Yeah, because this is something that the halls and the orchestras wouldn't want you doing.
It was frowned upon, and I did it in secret because I felt that capturing that soundscape, capturing musicians who typically do not think of themselves as improvisers, as improvising, and capturing a form of improvisation that is based in some ways on being inattentive to other groups, where musicians actually have the freedom of attention to start listening with each other and then stop listening and say, oh, well, so-and-so is playing the piccolo part at measure M. Great, well, I know there's a snare drum part, I'll go with them. Oh, wait, so they do four measures together. Oh, wait, you know, thinks one of the musicians, I've got another tough part here. Flips ahead or flips behind a few pages while the percussionist or maybe the clarinet player who joined in is doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
So there is... there's a self-generating labyrinth that goes on that can be liberating, and I think kind of disguises the importance of what's going on. But it has to be done in secret, because to get the clearances and to talk to the, you know, various musicians' unions, the permission of the venue, and then of course there's a question where if it comes out on a CD. When I began recording the intermissions, there was actually no intention of making a CD. It just happened rather you know, serendipitously, and thanks to the initiative of Jeff at GD Stereo, I mean, he was really the one who he made it happen. So people think, oh my goodness, there's going to be a bunch of money, there's going to be this. Well, you know, and I know that in this music, there isn't much money for anyone. It's all a labor of love. It's a gift culture, whether we acknowledge it or not. I kidnapped those musicians into the gift culture, and those, a few who I've spoke to who know that they were recorded, half of them thought it was great. They think, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, it's a great idea. And the other half, you know, kind of felt angry, cheated, like, oh, you know, you made us look bad. I said, well, that's why no orchestra is listed on the CD.
Right.
No, there's no credits. It's in a more perfect world, that would be there, and there would be multiple volumes of intermissions, and there would be multiple people recording it. So, you know, so there wouldn't be the danger of someone saying, oh, goodness, Holding Out for Ein Helden, that was recorded with the Blah-Di-Blah Symphony Orchestra. So someone goes, here's the Blah-Di-Blah Symphony Orchestra, and listens to their intermission and thinks, oh, well, that wasn't nearly as good as the one that De Laurenti recorded. You know, these guys must stink. Well, no, you have to go to a lot of intermissions to actually get... It's like with anything, the more gigs you go to, the harder it is to really find things that you feel really move you and will move other people. I've got acres and acres of intermissions. I've got a whole trove of opera intermissions that I didn't even listen to those when compiling that record. I figured, oh, I've got so much of this stuff, I have to just make some decisions, and figured, okay, it's only going to be orchestra intermissions. All the other kinds of intermissions, chamber music, the other things, that's off the table. And that's a separate project for, you know, some other day or some other year.
What's your ratio of recorded intermissions to ones that you feel are usable or savable? Or, well, they're probably all savable, but usable.
I don't like to think about it.
Okay.
Because, it's the ratio of field recording in general, where, you know, for every 10 hours, maybe there's a couple of minutes. Maybe
okay.
there's a few minutes that are really... amazing and wonderful. I know both. I know Gordon Hempton. He once told me his reject ratio, and I was shocked. It was somewhere around you know, for every 10 hours there were, you know, a few minutes
wow.
in there. But I mean, Gordon is one of the premier nature recordists in the world. So you know, I'm in a different kind of aesthetic and technical idea, even though he's amazing. A great guy, and his work is lovely and marvelous, but there are similar rejection ratios. Maybe more. I turn things down, or don't think that they're worth other people's time, because that is really what we're involved when mm-hmm. When we make music, when we present music, we're actually making it's a profound request. We're asking people to give part of their lives, and they won't get that back. My wife and I rented that film 2012 with John Cusack. You know, I like to see a Hollywood blockbuster every now and again. I was really interested in the boom crash stuff and the CGI and interested in seeing on how the world ended. And it was, I think it came on two DVDs because it was two-part. It was a really long movie. And we both thought it was terrible. And I don't know who said it. She said it or I said it. I was like, well, boy, wouldn't it be great to have the 2.5 hours back?
Uh-huh.
and that's what we are obligated when we are... you know, taking and asking people to listen, because that's what I do. For me, my work can be boiled down to one pretty simple thing, is that my job is to find interesting things for people to listen to. So I listen to a lot of boring things and terrible things. I make a lot of boring recordings and terrible recordings so other people don't have to listen to them.
The other thing, for people that haven't heard the Favorite Intermissions record, and you could find it certainly through GD Stereo,
yes.
or go back through some of my playlists, and
yep.
you can hear parts of it
yep.
On the station here in the archives. But it's not just the orchestras; you're also hearing the people in the audience.
Yes,
and there's an amazing sort of voyeuristic quality to listening to them. So it's very multi-layered, and I thought very enjoyable.
Oh, absolutely! Well, wait till you get to the opera intermissions. Holy, there's some juicy there's some juicy ones there.
But there's another. Piece of juicy gossip, I guess, that went with this record too, is the copy we have here is not the original cover.
Yes.
Can we talk about that?
Oh, sure, absolutely,
okay.
absolutely. And in a nutshell, what what happened is that GD Stereo released the first intermission CD, and we parodied the yellow marquee that you see on Deutsche Grammophon, old Deutsche Grammophon CDs and LPs, and it was a parody. Well, the folks at Universal Music, who the corporate parent of Deutsche Grammophon, found out about this. It certainly didn't help that there was my smiling mug on the front splash page of the New York Times website and a nice article about it, a nice and actually very accurate and thoughtful article, which is so seldom for folks who do what we do. So they saw that, and of course, what did they think? Well, they thought two things. Number one, they may have been worried that, oh goodness, here's some folks who are making some money, making piles of cash by copying our famous look and logo. And the second thing that they worried about was enforcing their trademark. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't enforce your trademark, then that can weaken and dilute your trademark, and other people can go and say, oh, well, gee, there's this and this and this, you're not really enforcing your trademark. So they essentially wielded a giant silver sledgehammer, and those who have spent some time in the legal system know that the threat of an avalanche or an army of lawyers coming to bankrupt you can force you to say, well, you know, I think we'll negotiate. We'll capitulate. Initially they wanted to destroy all of the copies. And what happened is that we got talking with them. Actually, I spent a lot of time talking with their attorneys, and we agreed that the thing that they found most objectionable, among other things, was really the cover. And so we said, well, how about a different cover? One of the accusations that the folks at Universal Music, their attorneys, leveled was that I was trying to profit and create a false connection with Deutsche Grammophon and to create a false association that somehow my work was affiliated mm-hmm. with theirs and connected with theirs in some way. And of course, they have their stable of artists, and they want to keep that going. Well, I found it really ironic, because what happened is that we talked and realized, well, if this is going to come out with another cover, we certainly don't want any legal brouhaha to happen again, so we should run it by them. Well, we should. And so we told them this, and they said, okay, sure, that's actually a good idea. So we sent one cover mock-up. They didn't like that. They said, oh, that's very sly. You're trying to pull one over on us. And we parodied the late 80s 20th century classics look. If folks who are DG fanatics have that, they were wonderfully photographed bits of construction paper that were well lit, creating gradients through light, not through computer graphics. Very amazing, a very amazing line. And so we parodied that. They said no. So finally, we came up with the current design, which is actually the top torn off. You see the tear, and the letters have been, the letters have lost a little bit of their luster. Is almost like a funeral, an armband that you would wear at a funeral. But this kind of put the whole CD in the position of having the cover art approved by the folks at Deutsche Grammophon, at Universal Music, I should say. So there was that's kind of an odd an odd collaboration that happened.
So the cover is corporate approved, but the recording isn't union approved.
That's correct. And because there are differences, there is the AF of M, but some orchestras do have their own unions as well. So that's generally prohibited. The venue also has their own prohibitions, because they don't want to tangle with the union. Myself, I decided, and I made the executive decision, that it was more important to preserve that soundscape than to seek out permission. So that's why all the groups are anonymous. And I found this because the concerts I would go to, most orchestras record their concerts. They'll just do a reference recording, quick and dirty, hang a couple of omnis, and that's it. Mm-hmm. Well, I would watch the gals and guys who ran the board at the back of the hall, and sure enough, like everybody else at intermission, they went and they had their coffee and had their smoke, as well they should, like everybody else, and that Pro Tools sessions was put on pause. So if no one else was recording the intermission, I figured, well, I had to do that. Myself, even if the CD, you know, had disappeared or had been completely destroyed or altered or whatnot, I still feel that the work, that the project was still successful, because I received and I still receive emails from people who find out about the CD. I remember one email from a woman in Argentina who said, well, I can't afford to buy your CD because it's overseas, it costs a lot, but when the next orchestra concert I go to, I'll make sure to listen at the intermission.
Nice.
And see if I hear anything. And that's it. Well, my work is done.
Right.
You know, of course you love it, you know, yeah, support the label, you know, buy the album, but that my work is done if they've done that and if people have done that. And I've heard from quite a few people who've done that, and that's so wonderful and gratifying because you know that A, what you have done might mean something to other people, and secondly, other folks find out, and if they think, if there's one person who did this and I do this, I bet there are other people who also mm-hmm. listen in this way. And that for me is the most powerful aspect of the work. When we listen to things and pay attention to things that we ordinarily do not, we open ourselves to transformation, to becoming different, to being challenged, to growing. And that, I think, is how, that's how good things happen, I think, in the world. And that's really, I mean, that's the root of all of it for me.
Well put. And it's not to belabor the point, but it surprised me. Maybe it's before Universal owned Deutsche Grammophon. I don't know, but that cover's been used a lot. I mean, Monty Python did it, right? Chris Cutler did it.
I have, well, and I'll stop you there because.
Oh, should I not say?
Because I assembled as part of the research for putting together a possible case, or at least to respond to negotiate with these folks. I found many precedents mm-hmm. of people parodying that cover, a few that were outright and quite close, like what we did, others who were a bit more abstracted. There were maybe 10 or a dozen, maybe two dozen, probably many more. I don't want to give an exact number just because I don't want to give those folks up. Because
right.
to patrol and to preserve their trademark, Universal Music would be obligated to go after those folks. So those of us in the scene or who listen to adventurous music kind of know, and we can wink and nod. And one possible defense that one attorney mentioned to me was to say, well, you could say, because I said, well, you know, lots of other people have done this. We didn't think it would be a problem. And one attorney said, well, you can bring that up, and that would actually be a powerful, powerful argument. But that would also throw quite a few other people, small labels, artists like myself, under the bus, mm-hmm. to use a current expression, and that's not acceptable. You know, let the megacorp lawyers, you know, root out their own rabbits.
Right. Okay, well,
yeah,
leave it there.
Yeah, so you know, so we'll leave it there. And quite frankly, if somebody else wanted to do that, then you know, they could probably get away with it, because they're not, you know, they're not actively on. Well, they are actively on patrol. I shouldn't say that. They are actively patrolling and trying to protect their trademarks and their copyrights. But for, you know, if you did a small homemade CDR, you could probably, you know, not raise any eyebrows. But when you do that sort of thing, you also have to understand that you're in a lifeboat and other people are with you.
Mm-hmm.
So that is something to really think about. When I've done quite a few Plunderphonics pieces, I ran into Wobbly at the EMP conference, and he said, oh, you know, I remember your Three Camels for Orchestra CD and you know, a lot of good sampling and collage, and are you still doing that? Well, I am. I do actually present a lot of those pieces live, but to release them, you know, that's a scary thing. Although, by contrast, I should mention that I had the chance to meet John Oswald briefly a few years ago, and I asked him about the Plunderphonics box set, the Marvelous reissue, and asked, "Well, have you heard anything from anyone?" And he said, "Nope, not a peep." And I'm like, "Phew, that's good."
Yeah.
But you never know. So it's a risk to put those things out, and you have to proceed carefully. Myself, I still make the work. I still present it if people want to hear it and come see me. They it's there. There will be more intermissions, and there are there are pieces I make that borrow and cull and steal. And they'll turn up various places, but try not to trumpet them too loudly, given what's happened.
But if people do want to come see you or come, check out the recordings, the best place to start is your website.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, my website, dlaurenti.net, and there are quite a few recordings. I give a lot of my work away, and typically what I do is I perform. I have several live sets that I keep in my repertoire for a few years, and then as new things move in, then old things either get released or I'll put them up on my site. So usually coming to see me live means that you'll hear or see something else. And I do try and rotate the content on the website, but like a lot of websites, it's sporadically maintained. But there's quite a lot of free stuff. Big MP3s, big and small, of various pieces.
Great. Well, thanks so much for coming up today.
Well, Kurt, thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
Absolutely.